CataractCoach.com podcast series episode number 98 with Dr. D. Stevenson, evolving your surgical technique and your private practice over the years. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. And today I have a very special guest, my dear friend, Dr. D. Stevenson from Venice, Florida. D, welcome to my podcast.
Thank you, Uday. It's been a long time coming. I watch your videos weekly, and they're really inspiring. I can't believe how many of them you've done. So this is such an honor for me to be interviewed by you. Pretty cool. After all these years,
I've learned a lot from you. You obviously have a passion for cataract surgery and teaching it. And yes. I first attended one of your lectures more than 20 years ago, and I loved your style.
Well, and I loved yours and your pinstripe suit and your pretty red tie and your pocket square. You always look so nice on the podium. It was a long time ago, wasn't it?
Yeah, we've had a lot of great time together. So, you know, even back then, you had a passion for everything new in ophthalmology. You always stayed really cutting edge, especially with that in the cataract surgery. Tell me about that philosophy and how you kind of keep up with that today.
Well, you know, what's funny is when I first went into practice, you know, I was newly married and I thought, oh, this is going to be great. You know, I have a 9-to-5 job, blah, 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 blah. But I realized that I'm in this town of Venice. I was on the other coast of Florida for a year and was very successful, but just didn't like the east coast of Florida. And I moved back to the west coast, which is where I'm from. But when I first started out, it was funny because I just wanted to do good surgery and take care of patients because I had such a wonderful mentor who I used to be able to cover his private practice when I was chief. So it was kind of one of those wonderful reward things that you don't get very often. So when I went into practice, I just was doing general ophthalmology. I was doing blefs. I was doing corneal transplants. I was doing all that. And I did muscle surgery. I mean, and all of a sudden I thought to myself, I hate all this stuff. I only want to do cataract surgery. There are other people that like doing this stuff. So then I decided to, it took me about 10 years, but I decided to, kind of step up the my game a bit. And what was fortunate for me was I decided that I was in between two huge groups, David Brown and David Shoemaker. And I was a girl, so I needed to do something a little bit different. You know, so I tried to stay on the cutting edge. I started to try to stay on the cutting edge, but Nick Curtis introduced me, a dear old friend from the Chiron days, and introduced me to Aura. So about 14, 15 years ago, I guess, 15 years ago now, it may even be longer. I was on board with Aura and worked with Michael Breen and later on Tom Frenzy put the whole program together, you know, and Pina Williams was my handler. You know, it was great technology and it really kind of put me in the forefront. It made me, you know, because not many people use it still to this day, but for me, it upped my game plan. I still use it on every case because even if it's 1% that I improve on the outcome, it's worth it to me to take, you know, a minute to do an Aura. So that was kind of my turning point. And then also not long after that, Nick Curtis started work for LensTech. LensR. And he and I had a conversation and I got a femto laser. So I did everything that the big guys did, but in a very small boutique practice that we donate all of our time and energy to that patient that's in the chair. They're the most important thing when they're there. In my office, in the chair, and when I'm in the operating room with them, you know, to make them, you know, at ease with the whole, you know, it's the whole thing. It's not just, it's 20 happy, not 2020 or 2015. It's 20 happy or, you know, most of my patients, I have to say, are happy patients, you know, but it's what you bring to the table. If you're happy and your office is upbeat and happy, and yes, we can help you, or geez, this is really going to be a tough case and I don't really do this. I'm going to get you to somebody that does do that, you know? So there is a little bit of that. We have to share. There's so many good and great ophthalmologists around and, you know, sharing your information with them and sharing patients is a very important thing. You know, you never talk bad about another doctor, even if the surgery was done incorrectly or, you know, a mistake that we all make. All break capsule. We all lose a lens. You know, there's all kinds of things that, you know, are very humbling to us. But, you know, the one thing that I think helped me was my mentor, John Wells, said there are two words of wisdom that he gave me. One was call your patients the night before surgery. And I've done that for 35 years. So I call my patients always the night before surgery. And then I call them the day of surgery. So once they've gone home, I call them that night. So they get two phone calls from me, one the night before and one the night of. And the other word of advice that he gave me, which is still something that I try to enhance my teaching abilities by telling residents and medical students this, is the day, if you're going to be a surgeon, the day you stop being nervous when you're in the operating room doing surgery is the day you need to retire.
Right.
So, you know, I've gotten a lot of, you know, it's so nice. Ophthalmology's changed so much, but with the technology changing, there's so many avenues to go down and there's so many people that you can learn from. And it's like, you know, why wouldn't you learn and do the very best you can for a patient? Or if you don't want to do it, send them to somebody that does. And that's kind of, you know, my motto. I do a lot of glaucoma. I don't do any cornea anymore. When I first came to town, I did corneal transplants, a lot of them, because there was a gentleman in town who has just passed away in the last couple of years, Doug Williamson, who had the first outpatient cataract facility in the country, was in Venice, Florida. And it was Doug Williamson's. And he just passed at 96 or 97. And I mean, he did all kinds of innovative things, but he was an intracapsular surgeon. So I got all these patients with corneal, with anterior chamber lenses that had corneal decompensation. So that's why I had so many in this community to do so many PKPs. But I decided against DSEC and DMEC. I watched a colleague of mine suck that tissue right up in the IA tip. And I thought, this isn't for me. I'm too old for this. You know, so I let the cornea guys do those. You know, I don't want to do that. But the glaucoma stuff is pretty straightforward, and you know, I enjoy doing that, and it helps patients. You know, it helps them with their ocular surface, and they're happier, and their eyes aren't red, and people don't say what's wrong with you, you know, kind of thing. So it, you know, it's all for the same thing. But I you know, what's so fun is to see the big eyed residents and fellows and the ones that, you know, they're so excited. They're like sponges and they want to learn. And the good thing too, and I think Uday, you've really been a big part of this kind of movement to really share everything.
Right.
You know, because our colleagues are, you know, there's fellowships now, there, you know, non-academic fellowships now that are real world stuff that we really, you know, because when I went into private practice, I had just changed from extra caps to FACO. So right. You know, so I, you know, it was exciting in FACO to, you know, and then the Chiron lens was one of the first foldable lenses in the STAR, and I used those. So they went through a smaller incision. So the evolution has been wonderful. But, you know, these young people really love bringing each other up. You know, they like, they don't, sure. It's not, and I think you've had a lot to do with that, because it's about you teach your experiences. You know, there's nothing like an experienced physician in anything that you do. I mean, when my mentor passed away a couple of years ago, but I used to call him at least once a week. And he may not have been doing the kind of cataract surgery I was doing. He might have been doing extra caps. But when I talked to him, a problem is a problem. If you've got an abnormal eye, you know, I mean, a physical exam is something that, you know, it doesn't lie. I mean, if you look hard enough, you're going to find the issue. And it was really wonderful to have somebody that was smarter, that I admired, that I loved, that I respected, that helped me make some great decisions about ophthalmology. And, you know, it's, I can't tell you how invaluable that is. And when you stand up there and you talk about all the experiences that you've had, and then you share all these world renowned surgeons doing certain techniques,
right.
And it's like, wow. And we all can learn from that. The there's two sides as far as I'm concerned. The hands-on with the doctor, with your mentor, is really, really important. But video for these kids, these young kids coming up, that's all they do. They spend their whole life on watching videos and such. So it's, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, you can't really, you've got to be able to teach them the way they want to learn, you know. And you know, so it's been you know,
it's been a fun ride.
Yeah, it's been a really fun ride. And industry, you know, we've you know, how fun has it been for us to be with industry people, because they need us and we need them. And now it's kind of they really get it. And, you know, they're being more respectful to their KOLs. They're realizing that teaching their product may not get in a residency program because somebody's not using it that's teaching the residents. So they try to be more open, and the companies seem to share knowledge with the residents, you know, and the next generation is really important, but where we've come from is more important.
Right.
And never to forget, you know, going back and looking at an eye and looking at the whole patient and figuring out what's going on and try to do the very best you can for them and be honest and say, this is going to be a tough case. You know, you got small pupils, you got dense cataract, you know, or you end up doing, you know, a procedure, you have to think really hard. And you think you know, you set yourself up for A, B, and C, giving yourself three outs or three ways to do something. And it's all, darn it, isn't it the fourth one that you have to learn on the sly? You know, I mean, it's tough sometimes. It's really tough sometimes. And it's hard because people are demanding and they see that, oh, everybody wants to be glasses free and so forth and so on. And yet they're really not a candidate for that. And then they want to know why. And then you tell them, they still don't understand. Then you bring their spouse or their partner in and you explain it again and they kind of understand. And some of those patients leave and go down the street and have a premium implant put in and then it rotates, or they have a zonular dehiscence, or they had trauma or whatever, and they end up with a very suboptimal outcome. And then they come back to you and it's like, I told you weren't supposed to do that. But you have to, you know, you have to hold their hands. And for you being in Beverly Hills, I imagine that, you know, patients can be very demanding. They pay a high dollar. They want high results. And I mean, we all try to look at it. I think all of the people that I call my friends that are my colleagues, that, you know, I think they always put their patients first before getting paid for something. It's so rewarding to have, you know, a difficult case and it come out well, or even just a simple case and it come out well, that they say, wow, I've never seen this well since I was 12 years old. Forever, you know, and it's unbelievable. So it's been a great ride. And I do think that industry is becoming more responsive to us. But, you know, it's a very shared type of thing now, or they're getting optometrists involved on their sales force, who they kind of understand a little bit more about the pharmacology of medications. And, you know, I used to do with B&L some of their, and I think you did this too, where you spoke to their new incoming trainees for the reps. And, you know, a lot of them, they have no knowledge of what the eye is. And, you know, I have asked that. In fact, I can brag on Frank Shields. He's done so well in his career, but we kind of started our careers together and Frank was a pharmaceutical rep. And then he asked me one day, he said, Dee, do you think I could be, I'm thinking about going, you know, seeing if I could get on the surgical side. And, you know, and he came in the operating room with me for probably a year before he ever applied for the job. So he knew what was going on with a cataract. And I always admired him for doing that, because, you know, I mean, he was with B&L forever. Now he's back. Elios was bought by B&L, so he's back at B&L. But, you know, I some of these reps, you know, you talk to them, and why? They have to know a little bit about the doctor, too. In other words, if you do DSEC and DMEC, don't come trying to sell me, you know, tissue, you know. I mean, you know what I mean? Learn what you're... You know, I mean, that's with any job. Learn what you're, who you're servicing, and you know, if you are just have the medicines for cataract surgery, then go to the cataract surgeon. Don't go to the cornea surgeon, or, you know, make sure that these patients or the doctors that you're going to are glaucoma, do glaucoma, because some people don't want to do any of it. And so I don't want to see it. You know, if you don't do a lot of glaucoma, you don't want to see every glaucoma rep there is for every medicine there is out there.
So, well, I mean, an important issue is, I did what you did. Initially, my first 6 years, I did anything ophthalmology. I did ptosis surgery, strabismus surgery, diabetic panretinal photocoagulation, obviously cataract surgery, glaucoma surgery, Ahmed valves. I mean, you name it, I did it. But then, like you, I kind of found a passion for cataract surgery. And then after about 6 years doing everything, I said, I want to specialize in just cataract and refractive.
Right.
And so I made that switch. And so I think we're better if we specialize in something that we're passionate about.
Exactly. And you know, that's the thing. Passionate, if you're passionate about something, teaching like you are, being the award-winning teacher of the year for how many years from your resident, I know, but it's wonderful. I was humbled, but I was very, very honored to be from our mentorship program at the Caribbean Eye and at ACOS for the Cedars Aspen. So I got a mentorship award. Teaching. Nice. So that was probably my most favorite. I mean, that's my most honored, because it meant the most to me. But, you know, the doing stuff that you shouldn't do, I mean, that's the one thing. These residents come out, some of them come out and they have no idea, because they didn't do very many cataracts, but they had, you know, you have to fill out all the boxes when you're a resident. But some of them come out with such incredible knowledge, and they have to be able to hone it in, because you can't do everything. You just can't do it. And you know, it's just, you can't do everything, and you can't do everything well. So pick the things that you are passionate about. But that alludes onto the patient too. and the whole patient care. You know, patients feel your passion. And I always say my surgery day has been Tuesday forever, because that's my mentor's day was Tuesday. And I always say, Tuesday is my favorite day of the week. It's when I do surgery. And they're like, you had a long day yesterday. And I said, yeah, but I loved it. So, you know, I have patients. I had a gentleman the other day that said, I'm so glad that I chose you to do my cataract surgery because you actually really care about me and what happens to my eyes. And I said, well, absolutely. I would never want anybody to think that I just willy-nilly take your cataract out and bye, see you later. And for me, you know, I do all my own post-ops. I don't have any, all the big ophthalmology groups here have all their optoms. You know, they own all the shops. So I do all my follow-up. And I was also too, Uday, I don't do PRK. I have to get it right the first time, you know? Right. And so I try really hard, and Aura has helped me with that, but also the new formulas and being able to hone down your own formula. And you know, it's everything's in a databank. I put all my data in a databank so that I'm able to actually say, well, you know, I changed one thing and made this so much better.
Sure.
And you only change one thing at a time. And that's, you know, what I try to, you know, enlighten residents, because if they, you know, worry about, do the same incision for 50 cases, measure your induced astigmatism. And it is a lot less. I mean, it's something you don't necessarily have to measure, but it makes it nice to know. You know, but then don't change your capsulotomy size, you know, at the same time, because you've got to, you know, the golden rule of, you know, I mean, if we all knew what the effective lens position was in every single eye, we would all hit a home run every single day.
Yeah,
you have to, you know, you have to really look at things in the, high hyperopes and high myopes and, you know, long eyes and short eyes. All that is so important. And those are the kind of things that you really have to, you can't make one decision based off one patient, you know, and you make mistakes and you got to learn from those. And boy, howdy, can some of those mistakes be very humbling, you know, because you think, God, I haven't done this. I haven't had this complication in 10,000 cases. Well, here's your time. You know, so here's your time to have a complication. So you have to, you know, you have to tread lightly with a lot of that stuff. And you also have to, tell the patient, be truthful with the patient. This was a difficult case. I had trouble with your pupil being small and I had to do a different procedure and it isn't what I would have chosen. It's going to take you a little longer to heal, but you're going to be fine. And continue to hold their hand. Continue to be kind to them. And don't say, you know, oh, I'll see you back in 6 months or whatever. You need to deal with what's happening right there and to make them happy. And I think a lot of us try really hard to do that. So I'm proud to be an ophthalmologist. I think this is an awesome field.
Right.
And I'm proud to have, you know, people come to me that say, oh, you know, I don't advertise. It's all word of mouth. So they come to me because, you know, Mr. Smith, you know, came to me and he referred me. So, you know, those are the wonderful things about ophthalmology. I'm not really a downside.
Yeah,
you know, looking back, do you? I mean, there's no downside.
Oh, no. If you're specializing in what you love, what you're passionate about, it's not even work. It's fun. Like you say, the operating room to me as well is my happy place. I love
going to my happy place too. Yeah.
Tell me a little bit more about your practice. So you said you have a boutique practice. Tell me about your practice.
Well, I've been in practice now 35, just started my 35th year. And wow. When I first moved to Venice, I was with another guy. I was not a partner. I just worked for him for a year. And then he had a heart attack and retired from ophthalmology. And I just moved my office down the street. And it's in an old 1926 Italian Renaissance house.
Oh, wow.
With hardwood floors and, you know, big, thick baseboards and, you know, it's really beautiful. And it's not really, it's like being at home. We kept the living room. We didn't, you know, the exam rooms were bedrooms. My office was a bedroom, you know, then there's a fireplace in it. And that's where my administrator sits. And so, so it's really cool. And I've had, you know, my administrator's been with me. I've been in practice for 35 years and she just retired as my full-time administrator last year, 2 years ago. So 33 years. She was my administrator, and she still works with me and works for me, does my payables and keeps me out of trouble with the IRS and, you know, all those things, prepares all that stuff for me. But I think in my office, you know, I only have two techs and I have two office people and then administrator/surgical counselor. So they've been with me a long time. So people get used to how, you know, they know Nancy at the front desk. They know Christy at the other front desk. There's one you check in, one you check out. And, you know, they have a relationship with them on the telephone. We don't use automated anything. We call them for their appointments to remind them. So we use no automated stuff. It's a easygoing practice when you walk in. And from the first moment, it should be a wonderful feeling. And we've tried to make it that way. And people really like, you know, my office, and they, you know, I got it really decorated for Christmas. So they were all, it's right on the corner too, the island here. And, so it's all decorated really pretty, but and I have really talented techs. They've gone the extra mile. You know, and if I think about my surgical outcomes, I have to give credit to my technician who always does my A scans and always does my Cassinis and always does my eye trace, because my results are based on her data.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, and that in a big practice, if you have a problem, you're going to have to chase it down to, wow, this, you know, this is the tech that this problem came from. And I don't, you know, we look over things. She looks them over. I look them over, and I look them over again and again before I go to the operating room. But, you know, a lot of my, or all, I should say all of my patients, you know, that have had surgery had the A scan done by Saray. So I have to give her credit, you know, and so,
do you have a surgery center on site too?
No, I do not. I have to go over the bridge, which is about 5 minutes away, and it's a freestanding, multi-specialty clinic, multi-specialty surgery. So what's nice is that, you know, we have all kinds of stuff, but orthopedics, and they do totals, and they do robotics, and, you know, so, and urology can't think of what else, but anyway, it's in GI, and so it's a multi-specialty, so it's always busy there. And
for sure.
And I have a day that I'm assigned to, of course it's a Tuesday, which I love. And you know, I'm very fortunate too, at the surgery center I have the same people all the time: my circulator, my scrub tech, and the circulator in there, and it runs my aura, because I handicapped, so she runs my aura, and she runs the, you know, does my microscope, and I could do my phaco fine, but you know, she does the femto with me. So it's a small group, a very tight run machine, and I take suggestions from them if patients are unhappy. And also too, I'm not always the one to calm them down or to bring them off the bridge. A lot of times my technicians, and they give you those cues when you come in to, like, you know, take a deep breath before you go in and see this patient because of X, Y, and Z. So I can't do what I do without those girls. And that kind of a close-knit family, if you will, and a very small family, we try to put that on to the patients from the moment they walk in, to make their experience in my office, whether they're coming for cataract surgery, just a routine exam, that they're the most important thing to me when they're sitting in my chair.
Mm-hmm.
And the girls do the same thing. And I'm all women's office as well. So, you know, whatever that means, it's just worked out that way. And, you know, it's nice too, because from a personal standpoint, that my daughter is now has her own child, and she's 29. And throughout my career, she's always either been in my office, or, you know, after school or whatever, or there's a picture of her there. And they, you know, every month I put a new picture in so the patients could see, you know, how Tess was growing up. And today I've got pictures of my grandson there.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So it's really kind of cool. So they followed her, and I have one patient, he's mentally challenged, but he's one of my most favorite patients. And he always says, "How's the baby?" And his mom goes, "Adam, the baby's 29. She has a baby of her own." He goes, "It'll always be a baby to me."
No, that's true.
But people, you know, they feel really, you know, like they're like, you know, like we care about them because we care about what's happening in the office. And we all try to, you know, put our best foot forward always. And it's not always perfect. There are some, I have to admit, there are some unhappy patients, but very few.
Right. Tell me about your involvement with American College of Eye Surgeons, American Board of Eye Surgery. Tell me about all that. Because I've heard it so many times over the years, but I'm not a part of either.
Right. Well, ACES is the American College of Eye Surgeons, and the ABES is the American Board of Eye Surgery. And the board did the testing and does the CME and that kind of stuff. And then the other is just an association. It's a combination now, ACES and C, which is Society of Excellence in Eye Care. So we have we're not merged, but we have two separate groups that run a meeting, the Caribbean Eye Meeting. And it was It was started about 27 years ago, and it was people that thought outside the box. You know,
okay.
Alan Aker, Lisa Arbacer, of course, Berkey, Ralph Berkey, and of course, Gail Martin. And these guys were unbelievable people. You know, they just thought out of the box. And they were the renegades, if you will. If you look back, Chuck Williamson was part of this. And Skip Nickerman at one time. And you know, these people really thought the only way to make ophthalmology's techniques and us a more powerful force to reckon with was to make surgery interesting and better and teach and hand it down. We always had a video competition for the meeting. I had the honor of being the president about 3 or 4 years ago, and then I was the recent past president of the American Board of Eye Surgery. I was the American Board of Eye Surgery for like 3 years was my term. You know, it's undergoing some changes right now, but it's been a great group because it's a small group. It's always in the Caribbean and or Puerto Rico. And we've had some great meetings, but it's always, we want to know, the talks that are given there are new techniques, new instrumentation, new something. It's got to be not given given before, you know, so we want to, we like all the new stuff, and it's getting to be a younger people are coming because it's a tell it like it is kind of thing. Well, actually, it was way before telling it like it is, because people stood up there and they would say, "That's crazy if you're going to do that." You know, that's crazy. Alan Aker would say, "No, it isn't. It works." You know, or Gail Martin would say, "No, it isn't. It works." You know, so it was really always in an entertaining meeting. But you always went away wanting to learn more, and they taught, they, you know, what a great bunch of people to have as mentors in a small group. And we all became friends, and it was a good meeting. It used to always be in Florida. Then we changed it when we merged and had the same meeting with C. And it's been fun. It's been really fun. And, you know, a lot of residents come now, and they have a mentorship program beforehand, the day before the meeting starts, so that we pay for their meeting. Registration and their couple of nights in the hotel. So they come and they have a mentorship program for half of a day on Thursday. And then our meeting starts on Friday and they get to rub elbows with all of us. And, that's, you know, that's really cool. Yeah. And we've made it too, so that they have like a, right after the mentorship program, they have like a cocktail hour with industry. So the industry gets to see those residents, you know, when the early on, so that they can get to know them. And a lot of times too, at the Caribbean Eye meeting, because it's usually in a nice place, a lot of the, you know, big people from the companies come, not just the reps. So, you know, it's kind of cool if you knew who Tom Frenzy was and wow, he's at this meeting. I mean, it that's a big deal, you know, and of course, you know, we have the Sheets Martin lecture, which is, a lecture that's the whoever we choose. Sherry Rowan is the, Sheets Martin lecture this year, and well-deserved honor. But, you know, we've had Marguerite McDonald, we've had Dick Lindstrom, we've had Vance Thompson, we've had Stephen Dell, Stephen Slade.
Yeah, all the, that's great.
Yeah.
Great
to have. So, but the talk, though, this is what's cool. The talk isn't about ophthalmology, it's about them.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it's really, Ike Ahmed came for me. You know, that was my last, you know, please, while I'm president, would you come? And he did. And it really cool, because you learn a lot about
are they just their personal lives or their path in life? Or what do you talk about?
Yeah. What did I talk about? How he, you know, being brown and being in Canada wasn't as easy as, you know, and his parents were Pakistani and that, you know, he's had trouble. He's gotten black eyes, physically black eyes, and he's such a calm guy. I can't imagine him doing that. But he just, you know, how his psyche works, you know, how he looks at things. And you know, again, he's a guy that never stops thinking about ophthalmology. But, you know, he shared his story of his parents and his children, and, you know, what he's done, and, you know, how he started in ophthalmology, and, you know, doing a fellowship. And, you know, and now that all the people in the world, if I could do it again, I'd go to Ike's fellowship.
No, great guy. I've invited him on the podcast many times. He has not wanted to do it. So,
well, he's very shy a little bit, if you will. I mean, not really, but kind of, especially if you talk about yourself. But you know, it's hard. It's hard talking about yourself. You know, these folks, like Stephen Dell, he laughed. He goes, "Oh my God!" And John Doan was our speaker last year. And John, what a great guy he is too. And if you don't, you know, I mean, it's just wonderful because these are just are real people. You know, they're real people that were outside the box thinkers, or they're very successful, and successful in ways that we don't even know about. You know, all the patents that people hold, and you know, all the stuff they did in, as an engineer student before they went into ophthalmology. You know, all those things, and that you don't ever hear that stuff. So it's a pretty big honor to have it, you know, to give the talk. And it'll be interesting to hear Sherry, because Sherry's, you know, reinvented herself several times, and you know, by choice of, you know, moving locations. And that's a hard thing to do when you get to be a certain age, you know. And anyway, so that's my story with the Cedars at, or I mean with the Aces Aves. And you know, a lot of good people. Cynthia Matosian with Miss Jackson was the president last year or 2 years ago, and Kirk Labor is the president of now, and Denise Visco was the president, and you know, Cynthia Matosian. And so it's been a good group of people that have took the meeting by, you know, I was the meeting planner for 7 years with Jim Lowden. So that was fun and very, very difficult. It's like herding cats to get doctors to spend their, you know, their
yeah. And their tell office. Me the American Board of Eye Surgery. So it's a separate board certification, different than the American Board of Ophthalmology.
Right. Well, and what does it entail? Well, it entails we're in the process of, we already have a certificate. We're trying, you know, we can actually, you know, we can cover CME. We can. We're trying to get it where the fellowships, the individual non-academic fellowships, can get a certification through that, to go ahead and get a certification. And it's a board that has, you know, we have a budget, and it's who holds the money. So, you know, we have a budget to.
Is there a test to take? Like, let's say I want to be certified by the American Board of Eye Surgery. What's the, is there like an
oral exam? Well, no, it's not a written exam. It's just, we used to review 50 cases. Cataract cases, and there was actually a doctor, like I went and certified Mitch Jackson, so I went and watched him do surgery, you know, I went and watched somebody else do surgery, and it was real kind of neat, got to know Mitch fairly well through that exchange. We'd been, you know, associates or, I mean, colleagues, but not really friends, and watched him do surgery, and then we had a board of doctors that we didn't have names on them or anything, and we kind of critiqued the critique the surgeries, and you know, and like if it, and they're real time, there's no editing to it, you know, so we have to look at cases that are done and in real time. So we've never been, anybody that's ever applied for that's never not gotten in, you know. And we did the same thing with the video competition with the residents, and you know, there, Gary Wirtz won when he was a resident. Denise Visco won when she was a resident. So, you know, it's kind of cool. And we look at those the same way, you know, where we look at the videos and then we critique them, and then we decide, you know, who's first, second, or third, or whatever, who's going to get this much money or that much money. So it was really interesting. And watching those videos, I learned so much. You know, my one thing, and I tell residents this, but you know, when I make my stab incision, I put a ink mark on the instrument, so that it makes an ink mark on my cornea where the incision is. Because you know how hard it is when you're looking for that second instrument, looking to put that second side port incision, you can't freaking find it. So, you know, I mark, but a resident taught me that. I mean, like 25 years ago. And I use that technique every day. I always give credit to, I said, I can't remember the resident's name, but it was a resident. And I was reviewing their video. And I thought that was the coolest little, you know, thing to learn. Where you don't look like a fool, you know, when you're in the operating room and your attending's going, hurry up, hurry up, hurry up, hurry up. I mean, it's not really, but they're breathing on your neck like hurry up, and you can't find your side port incision. So I think that was a pretty good pearl to give to other doctors and other residents coming in, you know. So that, you know, that's essentially the board does those things. We're in we're trying to see what else we can do, because as you know, there's so many meetings and so many organizations, and not everybody wants to be and pay all the dues to all the organizations. So we're trying to, you know, revamp it a little bit to make it more inspirational for the, you know, there's a buying group and there's some of that stuff too. So,
well, that you bring up a good point. And that's one of the challenges now. If you look at how many organizations want money out of us every year.
I know, it's crazy. It's, and the money's, in, you know, and what they give us in return is less and less.
Right.
You know, so you pay so much, you go, gosh, I'm paying for a, you know, $1,500 or $2,500 for one of these things. And I'm like, what am I? I don't even go to that meeting. Why am I even paying that? You know? And right. It is tough. And the other thing too is so many meetings are so similar. So it's nice when you can go to one that's a little bit different.
Right.
That's kind of breath of fresh air.
You probably got the American Board of Ophthalmology lifetime certification, right?
Yes.
Well, unfortunately, that ended.
Yes.
And so anyone who's like mid-90s or beyond, and when they graduate residency, like, I got to redo it every 10 years, which is no problem. My first 10 years, I had to go into a testing center, take a test. Okay, right. No problem there. The next one I did it 10 years later, it was just the quarterly questions, the online stuff. But then it just like, you know, I got to pay $200-something to them every year the rest of my life.
$300 for the rest of your life.
Whatever the number is. Every year the rest of my life? Like, I got to pay $1 a day to this organization. I've already taken your exam. What do I get out of this? Nothing.
Nothing. And it, you know, that's the hard part, I think, of ophthalmology is those kind of things. Because there's the ivory tower, the AAO meeting, and then there's the real-life ASCRS meeting. You know, there's a big difference in what's accepted and presented at those two meetings. And for me, AAO is not always as rewarding to me as ASCRS, you know.
No, I agree with you.
Yeah.
That's a whole nother bag of worms.
It is. And you want these residents to have the best of both worlds. And you have to learn. I mean, you have to do the AAO thing when you're young, but you don't, you know, it's kind of flat, you know, there's no excitement there in my opinion. And, you know, you don't learn about the cutting edge stuff unless you're watching the people on the podium on the different companies.
Even then, let me tell you, everything is available online right now.
It is. Well, and that's the good thing about COVID was that residents, if they weren't, you know, in a program where they couldn't actually hands-on, that's terrible, but they at least can learn and watch people do surgery. And then when they're ready, you know, they're ready, they can go in the operating room. But, you know, but that's what I'm saying, you know, and you can do these meetings by being online during the meetings, you know.
Well, I think the fun for me for any of the big meetings is it's actually the interaction with colleagues, friends. And actually what you were saying earlier is industry people. Like you mentioned our buddy Nick Curtis, who he's one of my weightlifting bros. I aspire to be as fit as him in my future too. But yeah, he's been. Gosh, people are in ophthalmology for life once they start.
I know. And it's like, and they also too, and Nick's one of those, in my opinion, at least to me, he is. He's never, his success has never really changed him. He's still the same sweet guy.
Sweet guy.
I mean, he is. He's just a sweetheart and a knowledgeable sweetheart. You know, he's done really, really, really well. I'm really proud of him. And I mean, you know, and I'm a Tom Frenzy sycophant. So I love Tommy and I think he's done a great job too. But, you know, he's never, no matter what he is, he's never too busy to talk with the old colleagues, you know. It's fun. That interaction is really fun. And I wouldn't have met, if I hadn't been involved with Bausch & Lomb early in my career, I don't know if I would have taken the path that I did to be a KOL, to be cutting edge stuff. You know, it was so much fun to do that and to be part of that.
Well, it was a neat time too, because remember, Vena Surgical was just formed like in the 90s. Right. They got a bunch of companies like Chiron and the IO Lab, and they put all the companies together, put them all together, and then that became VNL Surgical, which was great. Yeah. And
but it is great. And I mean, and you know, it's just it's exciting. They've got new stuff in the pipeline, they've got new leadership, they've got a lot of stuff that, you know, I'm excited for them. You know, to be a player. I mean, all the companies, Zeiss is doing incredibly well. And, you know, of course, Alcon is Alcon. And, And you know, there's a lot of new stuff coming out, and I can't wait. I can't wait. You know, I've used the new Envy multifocal lens, which I've had a lot of success with. So it's kind of interesting.
I'm doing a comparison. So now we have three of these multifocals. We've got the B&L Envy, we've got the Technis, the new Odyssey, and you've got the Alcon Panoptic. So I've been racking up volumes of all of them so I can do my own analysis and kind of figure out what the sweet spots are.
Well, and that's what I'm doing just with Panoptics and I don't use the Technis Odyssey, but with Envy and Panoptics. In fact, a very first patient that I did with an Envy had Panoptics in his other eye, so put an Envy in his dominant.
And what did the patient think? What do you like better?
Well, and you know, he's a really nice guy, and he's not real, he doesn't complain about much. And I said, do you have any, you know, halos or glare or funny things when you look at the car lights or anything? He goes, no, he says, if I cover this eye, it's very prominent. If I cover this eye, I can hardly tell that there's any changes in the lens or changes in the, and it was the Envy that he liked. He didn't like the Chiron as much. And that's just one patient's opinion. He didn't hate either one. But he said it is better. The halos and glare are better. But you know, that's the other thing. We've learned so much about these lenses, and we've learned so much about how the outcomes are. All of these lenses have their peculiarities, you know, and you sell it, you know, you want to sell it to them, but you don't want to, you want to undersell it to them and I always tell patients, you're going to have halos. You're going to have glare. And I got this from Blake Williamson. He said, the lens is working. You know, the lens is working. Halos in there. But, you know, it's a good way to look at it because they don't remember that you told them that. They don't remember. You didn't tell me I was going to have halos. And I said, of course I did. Well, that's what I came to you for. And, you know, and it's like, but are they less than? Yeah, and they're different. And I can tolerate them. I said, okay, then that's your answer. And most people get used to them. You know, you can quote percentages, you know, 3%. Of patients complain about this or it's you have to do an IOL exchange or whatever, but you can always do it the other way. Like my mother would do this. My mother would say 97% of patients are happy, you know, instead of 3% are unhappy, because 97 sounds a lot better than 3, but it's how you have to talk to patients, and they're smart. Patients are smart now, you know, excuse me.
they do a lot of Google homework ahead of time.
Oh my God, do they do a lot of Google homework? They do Google homework, and my website. We always tell. And if you have questions look on the website. There's some information, and the doctor would be happy to go over it for you when you see her for the first time or whatever. You know, they have a little spiel that they say, but you know, it's tough, and you do. And I try to not. If I'm going to use a new lens, I try to really put it in patients that are suitable for it, you know. And if somebody has a little epiretinal membrane, I'm going to try to talk them out of it until I've had more experience with the new product. You know, I mean,
that's a very smart way of doing it. Of course. Yeah. The other thing is, with any of these multifocals, you have to hit the refractive target of Plano to make them happy.
You absolutely do. You can't have leftover. You can't have leftover astigmatism. You just can't. You know. And ocular surface is so important. And I'm big. Proponent of ocular surface, we do it before. You know, I was hearing patients talk in a waiting room in another doctor's office about the light adjustable lens, and they were saying that, you know, yeah, you can have light adjustable lens. It doesn't matter what's going on with your cornea. I mean, these are the people talking. Yeah, the patients talking.
They got no clue.
Wow, they have no clue. But you know, you do have to really think about, you know. Ocular surface in my office, ocular surface from Florida, people all have allergies in their eye, dry eye, and everything in its brother blooms all year long. So, you know, we've got 270 different kind of palms, and they all bloom at different times, and oaks, and, you know, so allergy and dry eye are a big thing here, and it all those things really affect your outcome in your cataract, you know.
Of course, ultimately, you just want to give the patient the best outcome, but sometimes it's do you ever say no to a patient? Like, I don't want to do your surgery?
Yes, I do.
How do you say it? What's the wording? I got to copy you. What's your wording? What do you say?
Well, I have to say to patients, I have to be truthful with them, but I say, this is beyond my abilities. I'm not, I did this case about 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago now, and the patient had one part of the lens in the hat, in the bag, and the other in the sulcus. So they didn't have an UGG syndrome, but they had a lot of transillumination. And I went in, and the surgery was done a couple of years ago, and they missed his target completely because they told me he'd be glasses free. So I got in there and I couldn't get the lens out of the bag. I could get one haptic out and part of it, and I couldn't cut it because of it kept pulling on the zonule. So I stopped and I sent him to a retina doctor. These new retina doctors all do the Yamani technique.
Yeah, they're good.
Yeah, and they're really good. So I said, hey, I called him. I said, I didn't hurt you. I didn't make anything any worse, but I didn't help you either. But I need you to see this doctor. And he's actually kind of talked him out of it because he said he's got to, wear a pair of glasses and his vision's pretty good. So he's going to think about it before doing surgery. But if I don't feel comfortable with it, I'm not going to say, it's so easy to say, I'm going to take care of it. I can take care of it and I'll take care of you. But, I don't do some of the really tough stuff. I send that out because I just don't want to do it. I don't think it's good. I'm not good at it.
Yeah, share the love and the liability with your retina colleagues.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's true. And I have become more, I used to be a little less dependent on retina people, but I've become more dependent on them. So if the patient has anything, and I always tell the patient, the other doctor didn't tell me this. I said, you've probably had this epiretinal membrane for 5 years.
Right.
But we have such great technology now that can take a picture of your macula and it can actually show this where my naked eye cannot find that. So I want to make sure that I'm not going to do you harm. And let's have the retina doctor give us an opinion. And, it's amazing. And so many doctors are afraid to get second opinions if they lose the patient. If I'm going to lose a patient from sending it for a second opinion, then I'm not a very good, I don't care because they shouldn't be my patient anyway. I never mind getting a second opinion. It only makes me a better doctor because they think, well, you're the one that found it. And I said, well, I'm the one that just steered you in the right direction. And there's 10 ways to skin a cat. And if I can't do it the best way for the outcome on the patient, then I don't want to do it. I want somebody else to do it, that I know can do a good job. And we're fortunate that there's those doctors in our community, So that's kind of where I stand. I just want the patient happy.
That's sometimes elusive, but I do the same thing where if I know that the technology is not enough to make the patient happy,
right?
I just say, I don't want to do your surgery right now because I don't think I'll be able to satisfy your expectations.
Exactly. And there's nothing wrong with that. And I'm much rather a doc. In fact, I'm much rather a doc. I had a patient that they send me all the small pupils, some of these local general ophthalmologists, and they send me their small pupils, and small pupils don't bother me. I have no problem using hooks. I have no problem. I had an APX expander that was just wonderful. They don't make it, it's not in the U.S. anymore, but it was so easy to use, and it made the surgery so much easier. And it's like I feel real comfortable with that. But there's some things I don't feel comfortable with. But if you just use your just make them happy, but if their expectations are way more, you have to say, you have to be realistic. You can't be 20 years old anymore. I mean, it's like going to a plastic surgeon and say, I want to look like Candace Bergen did in Murphy Brown. It's like, well, first of all, you're not blonde or blue eyed and you're not, So that's your first clue that it's not going to happen, But be real. Patients have to be realistic with them. And I always say to a patient, what I want for you, I can't give you. Right. I want everything to be perfect, and your eye is not perfect. If we have a problem already, that problem is going to be there after the cataract's removed as well. So it's not going to be. It could be a lot better if you would go to see this doctor, or you really need to lower your expectations and just get a monofocal lens and wear a pair of glasses to read, because that's going to be your best bet. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with doing a monofocal lens, and they have astigmatism, a little bit of LRI or femto AI.
Right. I do that all the time. A lot of patients want maximum image quality. Do a beautiful monofocal lens and enjoy.
Exactly. Well, and I'm thinking to myself, what would I have put in my eye? I'm still thinking I'd have an LI61AO put in my eye. It's silicone. Yeah,
so,
It's most pristine vision. Patients still have that in their eye, and a lot of my patients are J2 and 20/20 intermediate and 20/20 at distance, and that's a monofocal eye.
Just small pupils?
No, well, some of them are small pupils, but a lot of them are terrific. I mean, that's the same platform that all this other stuff is built on. You know, it's a LI61AO is the same power from center to edge, right. So it's it doesn't increase. You know, if it's tilted or decentered, it doesn't affect the vision. And I have all these videographers, and they're all they're buddies, and they all wanted the. So I said, with all these other great lenses, you want that silicone lens? And they said, yeah, because it's got I've been reading all about the Abbey numbers and all this, and they know more about that because they're optics inclined, with their cameras. And, they've all picked the LI61AO. So there must be something to that,
Interesting. Interesting. Yeah.
Very interesting. What kind of implant would you have, Uday?
A monofocal for sure.
Yeah.
And I'm naturally -2 spherical with no sill.
Wow.
I can't give that up. That's amazing.
Well, my thing is I'm a latent hyperope, so I can't see without my glasses on for anything. I can't see far away, but I can put readers on. I'm a 120 plus 125 at distance and plus 250 at near. So, I kept trying to figure out why my reading glasses kept getting stronger. And I said, oh, crap, I need a refractive. And I'm a latent hypero. So, I used to be 20/10 and I didn't wear reading glasses until I was in my, mid 40s. And
yeah, I know that being -2 is just such a blessing. So,
well, it is.
My near vision is spectacular.
Yeah, you don't have to worry about the microscope or anything because you can adjust to all of that.
Yeah, most days for indoors in my clinic in the operating room, I just go without glasses. I see great. I leave the glasses on the dashboard of my car.
Yeah.
When I drive in, that's it. There's
nothing wrong with that because your world is right there, Slit lamp in the patient's face, and that's really all you need in operating microscope. So, yeah. Yeah, and I always tell patients, too, you know how well you see right now? You take your glasses off and you're an A-plus when you read.
Yeah.
And then when I put this intraocular lens in, you're going to be able to see up close, but you're going to be an A-minus. B plus A minus. You're not going to be.
That's the least way of putting it.
Yeah. You're just not going to have the same quality that you have right now. And if you don't want to give that up, because I have patients all the time say, I want to see better at distance, but I don't want you to take away my near vision. And I don't want those fancy lenses. So make them a -125 and they can read up close and they can see far, 20/40, 20/50 undercorrected, 20/40. Mm-hmm. And, then they love you too because they don't have to wear glasses to read. And that was their only goal.
Yeah. It also kind of depends where they're starting with. If you have a patient who's an ultra high myope, I have a new series on cataract coach called the Secret Series. I just give away all my best secrets.
Yeah.
So cool. One of them is lens calculus ultra high myope. You got a guy who's a 30 millimeter axial length, who's a -16. You make that patient about a -1, 1.5, the patient is in heaven.
Yep.
Because they're not expecting that razor sharp 1,000 feet away vision.
They're not, are they? That's great. I just did a -9. And that's kind of how he was first day. He said, wow, I've not ever seen this good, And he's 20/40, and he's got a light adjustable lens. So I've got to adjust him anyway. But, I'm wondering if I just leave him, some of these people just leave him a certain way. I mean, why not? Just lock him in there.
Well, yeah, even myopic people tend to have myopia on the brain. Even my glasses, I don't wear the full -2. I'm at 175. I like to be slightly undercorrected.
Yeah.
Like myopia, the way it looks. Yeah. And the same with people who are hyperopic like you, a latent hyperope who wants a monofocal lens, they're okay if they end up +0.25,
right,
but not good if they end up -0.5.
No.
They're just not going to like it. This is what their brain's used to.
Right, exactly.
But even the toughest of all is patients who come to you who have their plano -2 at 180.
Right.
They never wear glasses.
No. Nope.
And they're used to looking at the world through just sill.
Yeah.
The two adaptive astigmatism, because one focal point is plano, the other focal point is -2. How do you do their surgery?
So yeah, it's tough.
You put the torque in and you hit plano, now you've taken away all their near.
Right, every bit of it. And that's I always tell patients too, remember we're only going to do this, we really only want to do this one time.
Yeah, for sure.
So don't have buyer's remorse by saying, oh, I wish I'd had that presbyopia correcting lens because, I could see with, now I have to wear readers for everything I do. And I never had to do that. Mm-hmm. And we try to tell them, my office, my surgical counselor, and I'll say, and the technician always says, if you want this kind of lens, you will not, if we make you your dominant eye for distance, you're making both of your eyes for distance, you're going to have to wear reading glasses. Well, you don't have to wear them now. Well, all that changes. you know, the anatomy changes. Once we take your God-given lens out and put an implant in, we can calculate it and manipulate it a little bit, but we can't manipulate it a whole lot, mm-hmm. you know, or you're going to be like you are right now. Well, I like the way I am right now, but I just don't see good. So it's like, sometimes it's just a never ending conversation with them, but it keeps
it exciting for us.
It does. It sure does.
I can't thank you enough. I can't believe we've been chatting for an hour already.
Well, that's wonderful. That's how it always is with you, Uday. I love chatting.
I've really cherished our friendship over the years. Learned so much from each other, especially from you. I just love your approach to all these things.
Well, and thank you.
Hope to see it. Hopefully the Caribbean Eye meeting coming up. I'll try it on my calendar. It's a little bit of a challenge, but we'll try.
Well, you've been traveling so much, you know, however many countries you've been to this year is unbelievable. 21.
Yeah, it's quite the path.
Yes. Well, Uday, keep doing what you're doing. You know, you're such a fabulous guy. I love being around you, but you're such an awesome creature. And yes, it's been a wonderful friendship and I can't thank you enough. And today was fun. And thank you so much for asking me.
Of course. I've admired you for many years. And I'm glad everyone else can now enjoy and take a listen to our conversation and, you know, learn from you as well.
Exactly. Thank you, Uday. I appreciate your kindness.
All right. I want to remind our listeners and viewers, remember, get a new podcast every week. Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google, anywhere you get podcasts, you find the Cattle Coach podcast. Plus, of course, we got a new Cattle Coach video every single day. We're 2,400 something videos and counting. We're not stopping. So until next time, I'll catch you later.